One of the questions so many people have about the campfire is how and why it behaved the way it did, especially the speed with which it moved through the canyons. So we decided to ask two experts. Earlier, I was joined in studio by pyrogeographer Zeke Lunder, who's been on incident management teams for more than 20 years. He's a mapping specialist with the U.S. Forest Service and CAL FIRE. And Don Henkins, he's a professor at Cal State Chico and also a pyrogeographer. I started by asking Zeke what elements came together to make the campfire so fast and so deadly.
I think all of us who study fire are still trying to figure that out. Fires keep exceeding our expectations, and right when we think that the car fire is, you know, the most destructive thing that we could possibly experience, then we have something like this fire that's almost an order of magnitude more destructive.
Apparently this area, the Jarbo Gap, is one of the most fire-prone areas in California. How is that? Why is that?
The watershed above Jarbo Gap is about 2,000 square miles. At night, the cold air sinks off of those peaks and it comes down and it's kind of focused by the canyon and drains right to that point at Jarbo Gap. And right at Jarbo Gap, the Feather River does a big bend called Big Bend before it enters Lake Orville. So the wind kind of piles up at that bend and it pours over the ridge at Jarbo Gap. The way that the Feather River cuts a gap through the crest, it means that when we have these continental north and east wind events, the whole watershed kind of can funnel this continental scale weather and wind through the Sierra and out into the valley. In the lead up to this campfire, we had at least a week of kind of extended north and east winds blowing across the landscape. And those winds are completely dry because they're coming off of the Great Basin and off the desert where there's just no vegetation that has any moisture. The same winds were able to push the fire up and out of the Feather River Canyon and spread them across Concow to Paradise really quickly.
In the wake of the car fire and with this fire, Secretary of Interior Zinke and Secretary Sonny Perdue of the Agriculture Department came to California and have been promoting something called forest management or better forest management techniques without getting into many specifics. What are the specifics of forest management? How does it work and how does it work economically?
Forest management is one of those things that it's incredibly site-specific and complex and doesn't really lead itself very well to national scale solutions or soundbite solutions. One of the key problems we're having politically is there's no level of trust around forestry issues in this country. During the 1980s, the Forest Service really logged heavily across most of the West and really didn't stop until there were major lawsuits around the spotted owl. So when people hear Donald Trump and his cabinet say that they'd like to see more forest management, everyone just assumes that they mean cutting all the big trees. You know, we know that cutting the big trees isn't the way to fireproof the forests, but the economics are such that it costs a lot of money to log small logs. Even if there's a market for the lumber, it costs a lot of money to move logs out of the forest and to mills. All these things have to be addressed when we talk about how we're going to use forestry to manage for fuels.
Don?
And thinking about, you know, forest management on its own, you know, thinking about logging or removal of some of this material, there's always the residuals that are left behind. So when it comes back to the fire question itself is, you know, fire is part of the land. You cannot regulate fire out of the landscape. It's always going to be there. So when we come in and we remove trees or remove some of this biomass, there's always the residuals that are left behind that are there, dead, decomposing, dry. And when you have a source of ignition, that's a source of fuel that can spread that fire.
So trying to solve one problem, it's almost as if policymakers have created another one. By thinning out the trees on theory that that the fire wouldn't spread as fast, when the winds are higher, it's actually spreading even faster. Zeke?
When we talk about fire behavior in forests, one of the most important factors in driving fire spread is wind at the surface level. So if you go into an old growth forest on a really windy day, your hair's not flapping in your face, your hat's not blowing off. There's really gentle winds at the forest floor. If you overthin a forest or if you clear cut it, you've got no protection from that wind. And a long history of different management activities in the Concow Basin, the fire that burned through in 2008 killed a large proportion of the trees that were growing for timber in Concow. And that was all logged after the 2008 fires, which really opened up that whole basin to more wind blowing on the ground. And so this fire that we just had, there was really no canopy left in a lot of the areas where the fire initially spread to slow the wind. So we had, you know, these 50-mile-an-hour winds or higher, and they were pretty much blowing directly on the surface and blowing those surface flames. It's been no secret in the fire world that Paradise was one of those places with extreme hazard. One thing Paradise has had going for it that's kept it here for so long is that Chico's got an air tanker base. So for at least the last 30 or 40 years, we've had this air tanker base in Chico, and every time a fire gets going, you know, by the time it's, you know, 2 acres on the Skyway, we've got 5 air tankers dropping mud on it. It's prolonged this kind of illusion of safety for Paradise.
And in this instance, they couldn't get the air tankers up there because the fire was kicking off so much smoke, and it was still before first light.
Right. There's days when we can't use them, and those are the days when the fires really run. So we talk about, you know, that maybe we can put out 95% of the fires. And as there's those 5% of the days in the year when there's weather that just we can't put them out. These large air tankers are fooling people into thinking that they can safely build in these really fire-prone environments. And once it's in that urban environment and burning from house to house, there's nothing we can do.
Don?
And the houses are fuel on their own, which we often kind of forget. You know, I've had, after the Tubbs fire last year, I had families in Chico who, you know, in particular, who live in, you know, in California Park area, you know, ask me, well, do you think that could happen here? Absolutely. Those are fuel. Your house is fuel. It's made mostly, most of the houses are made out of sticks that come from the forest that are now dry, and it's fuel. So we have to think about how do you minimize ignition within that fuel, you know, the construction style, the vents, the vegetation adjacent to it, the sources of embers that could come in. Those are all factors that play into it. And so anywhere where you have a source of ignition potential, even in San Francisco, you have to worry about this, right?
Yeah. And I've heard some people talking about, in talking about rebuilding Paradise, saying, hey, look, we've got more modern building codes and the new homes will be more defensible. That's true, but the new building codes took effect in 2008. Of the homes that have been built in the campfire footprint, 280 homes built since 2008 with the new building codes were damaged by the fire, and I think 240 of them were destroyed.
What other communities in the foothills are uniquely vulnerable?
There's portions of Forest Ranch that are incredibly thick with fuels. And like Concho, you know, there's portions of Forest Ranch that are exposed to north winds. Also, Cohasset is exposed to north winds. And there's potential there for us to have similar, really destructive fires.
A homeowner could look at where they're, you know, if somebody was looking to move into a place, looking at the lay of the land, the landforms, as Zeke was talking about, with the Feather River drainage and what that network looks like. You know, anything that kind of funnels air masses down through a canyon are places to be more aware, at least, of these situations. So I think we need to really start to think about rebuilding. I like to think about it as a culture of fire, you know, where we're all engaged with the support for and or the use of fire within the landscape, and we've got to get ourselves back into that.
That requires us not to be afraid of fire. I think, you know, coming out of this, the campfire, it's kind of like 9/11, where we watched the videos of the airplanes hitting the buildings over and over and over, and we just became traumatized by this imagery. And I think we need to be careful not to let ourselves be traumatized by the imagery of the campfire, because we need fire. We need to be all right with fire. There's a lot of ways we can use fire. Fire is the only tool we really have to become safe inhabitants and tenders of this landscapes.
What are some ways that are effective and affordable on a policy-wise to reduce fire danger?
Well, I think one of the hurdles that's there in California is the liability aspect of it, in terms of, you know, every time a person sets fire, as he was just talking about, the risk is there that, you know, if the fire got out of control, if it spread across that particular property, there's the risk of the liability of that fire damaging other property. We need to see some changes in policy at that level. Until we see that shift, we're going to have a reluctance to use fire in some places.
So fighting fire with fire.
Yes.
Yeah.
Don, Zeke, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Zeke Lunder and Don Hankins, both pyrogeographers based here in Chico, speaking with us at our studios.